We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover this morning, starting with liquor distribution.
Yeah, this week the State Budget Office, the Office of Financial Management is the actual name of it, recommended that the State Liquor Control Board reject both proposals to privatize liquor distribution in the state of Washington. Now, the legislature had indicated they wanted the State Liquor Control Board and the Office of Financial Management to ask for proposals to privatize liquor distribution, not retail liquor outlets in the state of Washington, with the idea that by privatizing the distribution system, that this would bring in more money for the state's coffers. But what the Office of Financial Management found after reviewing the two proposals that they received is that neither one of them makes sense because the state can do distribution much more efficiently by controlling its own distribution system. One of the proposals only achieved an increase in revenue by raising the price of liquor, the retail price of liquor. The other was based on an increase in sales that isn't likely through the current retail system in the state of Washington, particularly during a recession. So the Office of Financial Management essentially said, well, you know, because our current state distribution system costs are only about 1.7% of gross sales, we consider that to be extremely efficient, our state-owned distribution system. So we recommend that you don't privatize liquor distribution
of course,
in Washington.
Of course, the entire retail system could be privatized in another 4 days.
Yeah, and that's going to make Costco pretty happy, this decision, because if the state had decided to privatize the liquor distribution system, that could have thrown a monkey wrench into the works if I-1183 passes. Now,
you want to explain why that's the case?
Well, clearly because I-1183 has provisions in it that would privatize the entire system versus just distribution or just retail. So then the legislature would have to reconcile the two, and that could take time and could be a problem, and there could be court challenges, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the Office of Financial Management has looked at the costs of privatizing the entire system, has looked at what I-1183, if it passes, might cost the state, and they've determined that the state could take in an increase of about $80 million a year if I-1183 passes. But that's forecast is based on a couple of things. One of them is the wider availability and the increased sales of hard liquor. And what I find interesting is the opponents of the proponents of I-1183 are saying if you pass this law, sure you'd be privatizing liquor sales, but sales of hard liquor are not going to increase. However, when they say, oh, we'll bring in, you know, tens of millions of dollars more for, you know, cops and fire departments and public health, et cetera, that estimate relies on increased liquor sales. So it's a contradiction there.
They're trying to have it both ways.
Yeah, they're trying to have it both ways, and they can't. And there's really something to be said. You might see that the ads this week are all about the public health issues involved with increased alcohol consumption. There is something to be said for making hard alcohol as easy to get as buying your groceries or buying a pack of gum. It will increase drinking, and there is a public health impact to that. If you pay attention to the science news, you know that there are definite illnesses linked with increased alcohol consumption. This week, for example, we got the news that breast cancer is linked very directly to an increase in alcohol consumption, so much so that doctors are now telling women who don't drink not to take the advice of their heart doctors, who say that having a little bit of red wine can help you fight off heart disease. Their other doctors, gynecologists in particular, are telling women, don't start drinking if you're not a drinker, because the increased risk of breast cancer is directly linked to increased alcohol consumption. And breast cancer, I want to remind people, is not just a women's disease. Men can also get it, too. There are other public health concerns like drunk driving, for example, liver and kidney disease, throat and stomach cancers, and brain damage, and of course, the unmeasurable damage to personal relationships that increases in alcohol consumption often bring, particularly during a recession.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Moving on. Darcy Burner sounding like she's going to throw her hat in the ring this week.
Oh, she already has. She made it official this week. So we now have six people ostensibly running for Jay Inslee's open seat in the first congressional district, which has been north of Seattle. North Seattle, the northeast side, a little bit of Kitsap County, a little bit of Snohomish. But the trick with this is that nobody knows what seat they're running for yet because the redistricting plan won't be finalized until early next year. However, given how much money has to be raised for congressional seats, and particularly a very competitive one like this, and particularly a heavily Democratic one like this, where because there's not likely to be a strong Republican challenger, the real competition is going to be among the six or more Democrats running, and that will be decided in the primary in August rather than in November, so there's less time to actually run. So they're having to get out and fundraise and set up their campaign infrastructure now, even if though they don't actually know whether they're living in the district for which they're running. And that's particularly a problem with Burner, who lives out in Carnation, away from the population centers of much of what is now in the 1st District. She could easily be put back into the 8th District where her house had been previously. It could be part of the newly created 10th District that Washington State will be added. It depends on which of the proposals for redistricting is now passed, or how they're combined and amended between now and January or February. So she's in the ring. She has very high name ID. She has a lot of ability to fundraise, and it's been very interesting to see that the local political press has pretty much savaged her this week for a lot of the same reasons that they didn't really care for her when she ran for Congress against Dave Reichert. Although one of the criticisms that she has not actually done anything is really no longer true, because she's been spending the last 4 years running a progressive lobbying outfit out of Washington, D.C. that had a lot of impact, particularly on the health care reform legislation. So she's been in D.C. She's been sort of paying her dues since she last ran for Congress. But it will be very interesting to see whether, as some of the other more established state legislators and others who are also running for the race raise money and get out, what the media coverage is going to be among that, and how that's going to shake out.
All right.
And who's actually going to be in the 1st District.
Moving on to national and greenhouse gases.
The U.S. Department of Energy released figures for 2010 this week for greenhouse gas emissions, showing that the emissions were worse than the worst-case scenarios were 4 years ago. The world pumped about 564 million more tons of carbon into the air in 2010 than it did in 2009. That's an increase of 6%, which is an enormous increase for only 12 months. The interesting part of this was that the increase itself was more than the individual emissions of all but the three leading countries in the world, which are China, the U.S., and India. And of that increase, China and the United States accounted for over half the increase. So the interesting part about this also, aside from the United States, most of the rest of the Western developed world is actually hitting its Kyoto Protocol targets for greenhouse gas reductions, but the U.S. is increasing so much, much more in line with economies like China and India, that it more than outweighs the rest of the Western world.
There are other things that put us in line with economies like China and Russia and India. You could call our political system equivalent to one that you might find in a developing world country as well. That and our in our income disparity as well.
Yeah, and that political system and the economic inequalities that drive it is a primary reason why this country has not only done nothing on greenhouse gas emissions, but has actively opposed efforts to do something on greenhouse gas emissions by other countries as well.
All right. Moving on. The general strike in Oakland this week.
Yeah, well, this week saw a major escalation in tactics in the Occupy movement with the general strike that was held on Wednesday in Oakland, and I'll talk a little bit about the violence and fracas that happened overnight next. But first, I want to focus on the general strike itself, which by just about every account was pretty widely successful. probably somewhere between 10 and 15% of students and businesses and workers in Oakland participated. And the port of Oakland, which is the fifth largest port in the United States, was shut down in the afternoon by some, depending on which estimate you believe, anywhere between 10 and 40,000 people rallying. That's a lot more than the few hundred people who have been participating in encampments at any given time in most of the larger encampments around the United States. And it marks a dramatic escalation both in tactics and number of participants for the Occupy movement. And it raises an interesting question of where the Occupy movement goes from here, because most cities where this is taking place let's be clear, Seattle is not a real good representation of what's happening with the Occupy movement, because most of the encampments right now are in smaller cities, just numerically, because there are a lot more smaller cities and places where you wouldn't expect them, places like Lubbock, Texas, and Montgomery, Alabama, and Columbia, South Carolina, that simply haven't seen protests like this before, and a lot of northern cities as well, where there's been a lot of economic dislocation. You're not going to see that level of militancy in those cities. You're just not. You're not going to see a general strike. You're not going to see mass rallies. But one of the things that you are seeing is the opening up of either homeless shelters or encampments or squats in buildings that have been foreclosed upon. That's happening in a number of different cities now, particularly as the weather turns colder in colder climates. And you're also starting to see a little bit more organization come to the fore in terms of tying it to specific political demands or alliances with existing groups that have infrastructure, such as, you know, unions and other organizations that have staff that they can actually apply to the infrastructure of getting something like this sustained. So the short version of this is that the Occupy movement isn't going anywhere anytime soon, but it is evolving very quickly. And we'll see where that goes. The encampment here in Seattle has had a number of problems. They moved last week up to Seattle Central Community College.
That was a mistake.
You can see the arguments both ways, because they were going to get evicted from downtown sooner or later anyways, particularly with the carousel coming and the pressure from the downtown merchants to clear them out before the retail season really starts, which it now has.
Yeah.
But it certainly has reduced their visibility, has taken them away from where more people are, and it's put them on private property. So they're really at this point at the mercy of how long Seattle Central Community College wants them to wants them to stay there, or is willing to tolerate them staying there.
My feeling is that if they were going to move, they should move to a public place like City Hall or the federal building, something like that.
Well, the problem with those is that there's almost no foot traffic there for the better
part
of the 24
hours. But that's almost the same as being up on Broadway and Pine. I mean, there's more foot traffic there, but it's not the people you need to really talk to about this.
Yeah, that's true. So the other piece of that is that there's still a lot of tension both in Seattle and, as we saw this week, in Oakland within the Occupy movement, in terms of people who want to do property destruction, people who want to see the revolution happening now, and so forth. And you know, the frustrating part of that is when things like that happen. In the case of Oakland, you had people literally setting up barricades like it was Paris in 1968. You know, it alienates the larger, as Maria says, the folks you need to be talking with, the larger chunk of the United States population, you know, the larger chunk of the 99%, who so far have been broadly sympathetic to the Occupy movement. But that sympathy could change very quickly if the movement renounces its nonviolence, if the movement becomes too politically extreme, or if the movement is seen as being its face is seen as being of people that are not seen as sympathetic. And so that's a real danger that's having to be reconciled with the fact that, you know, there are no leaders in this movement and no one person or no one group speaks for them. So it's going to be a very delicate juggling act going forward, and we'll see whether, as the inevitable attacks in the media and in the political sphere come on the movement, how they respond to that, and whether it's resilient enough to continue to enjoy that kind of public support.
All right, let's move on. Speaking of juggling acts, this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week there was a study by Citizens for Tax Justice. They looked at the average tax rate paid by large corporations in the United States. They analyzed 280 large corporations and their disclosure in terms of what they think they might be paying in tax over 3 years from 2008 to 2010.
And I'm guessing this is a reason why people might want to go camping.
Yes, this might be this might be a good excuse to go join the 99 percenters over at Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Seattle. They found that the actual average tax rate is much lower than the 35% aspirational rate. I call it aspirational because that's what you and I hope that corporations are paying, but they're not. They're paying on average about 18.5%. The of the 280 companies studied, only one quarter paid more than 30%. One quarter of them owed less than 10%, and about 30 companies had zero tax liability, even though many of them were profitable. For example, Boeing is a profitable corporation in all three of those years, and they had zero tax liability. And Paccar is also another company that had zero tax liability over those 3 years and is a very profitable company. How do Boeing and Paccar avoid paying taxes? Well, Boeing is one of the largest recipients of government tax subsidies. They receive $3.6 billion in tax subsidies from the U.S. government, which erases their tax liability.
And that's separate from all the contracts they have.
Oh, yeah. That's separate from all of the contracts that taxpayers give them in terms of buying airplanes for defense purposes, and not just airplanes, but also things like drones and that sort of thing. Paccar, most of its income is earned overseas. They actually had a 30.5% negative tax liability. Now, if you have what is considered a tax loss in any year, you can carry that loss back to earlier profitable years in order to get a tax refund. I just want to remind people of the net operating loss carryback rules and that those rules were recently expanded for corporations, for companies, so that they could carry their negative tax liability back even further to gain more tax refunds.
And we could say that that's the aspirational rate from the corporate point of view.
Yes, exactly. And then the study, though, didn't look at Microsoft, and here's the reason why. Microsoft was excluded because researchers found that their allocation of U.S. income versus foreign income was, quote-unquote, obviously ridiculous. Because Microsoft has... Microsoft has order centers in Ireland, Singapore, and Puerto Rico, so they can claim that two-thirds of their income is foreign-earned, even though many of their products are produced here in the U.S. because you call someone or you email someone or they have their websites in a foreign country, then they can claim that as foreign income, and foreign income is not taxed in the United States.
I've always thought of Redmond as kind of a foreign country.
Yeah, you could argue that Redmond is a foreign country, or that the Microsoft campus is a foreign country.
Oh, but that's true for sure.
But there's a little bit of ammunition for those of you standing out on the street trying to persuade people that yes, the 1% needs to pay more in tax.
All right. Other economic news?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the bankruptcy of MF Global. That's the investment firm run by the former New Jersey governor, John Corzine, who was also a former head of Goldman Sachs. John Corzine's company, MF Global, had to declare bankruptcy this week, and regulators were looking very closely at MF Global because it appears that the firm borrowed money from their clients to invest in European sovereign debt, and that's what sank the company. Again, this is proprietary trading on behalf of the firm itself. MF Global used what is called used a type of loan that would have been that there's actually a rule that was being considered earlier this year by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, also currently run by a former Goldman Sachs official that Corzine has actually worked with, Gary Gensler. They were considering a rule that would have banned this kind of loan where big investment companies could use the collateral of the securities that they purchased in order to take a loan from their customers to trade for on behalf of the firm. That kind of a loan would have been banned by this rule proposed by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, but Corzine got on the phone with Gensler on the day that the vote was being taken on this rule, and he basically told him, look, you can't pass this because this would be detrimental to the economy, and it would put the brakes on large investment firms like mine.
It would inconvenience the
1%. And Gensler agreed with him and put the rule on hold. And now here we have MF Global having gone under precisely because they did what that rule would have prevented. And it really points out that the Volcker rule, which I talked about a little bit last week, really needs to pass, and it should pass in its original, not in the current modified 280-page form, but in its original 10-page form as it was proposed by Volcker himself.
What is the Volcker rule?
The Volcker rule would prohibit proprietary trading by investment and other large financial firms, proprietary trading being the act of the firm buying and selling securities for its own purposes, not for its clients. It really points out that the fact that Dodd-Frank the regulators are not following through and passing real regulations in the wake of Dodd-Frank, that needs to change, and it needs to change very soon.
Meanwhile, I think unlike many of the rest of us, I can't imagine that John Corzine is either going to suffer many financial consequences from this or be out of work for very long.
No.
All right. Let's move on. News out this week in regards to crack cocaine sentencing.
Yeah, you may remember earlier this year, the U.S. Sentencing Commission finally ended the disparity of a 100-to-1 ratio between the federal minimum sentences for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine use or distribution. That was reformed, and it was also reformed so that the mandatory sentencing guidelines only kicked in with a much higher minimum threshold for crack cocaine, which really eliminated the casual users and focused it on the distributors, which pretty much ended the racial disparity, which was the real problem with this. So because crack cocaine was much more heavily concentrated in its use in the African American community, the net effect of the sentencing disparity was a huge disparity over representation of African Americans in terms of getting much longer jail sentences and making it much more difficult for them to get parole or get out. So that went into effect this week. As of Tuesday, some 12,000 federal inmates became eligible for sentence reductions, and some 1,800 of them are eligible to be released right away. So that's a piece of good news that those folks have served their time, or what should have been their time, and it again is one of the positive things that can come out of the Obama administration and having at least some measure of relative sanity in the executive branch, at least for the time being.
All right. And developments with the super committee?
Yeah, the Cat Food Commission, so-called because seniors on fixed incomes are going to be using that as their primary food staple if these folks have their way, is stalemated. And the reason they're stalemated is the Republican refusal to consider any kind of revenue measures, even though it's fairly obvious that if they're going to come to any kind of agreement by the end of this month, which is their deadline, it's going to have to involve both entitlement programs and some form of revenue increases for the federal budget. Now, if they do not come to an agreement, you're going to see mandatory reductions both in the entitlement programs and in the Pentagon's budget. And you're starting to see an enormous amount of lobbying from panicked Pentagon officials and military contractors who are seeing their gravy train being threatened. And you're also seeing to see some cracks in the Republican congressional monolith in terms of opposition to revenue increases as they come under increased pressure from their sugar daddies, campaign contributors. But whether this gets resolved in time for them to actually meet that deadline and get anything enacted, or whether in some ways it might be better to have the reductions to the Pentagon spending rather than what they're likely to come up with in terms of a compromise, because we all know what happens when Democrats threaten to compromise.
All right. Let's jump to international. If we have time, we can bounce back.
Sure.
Starting with Japan, Fukushima.
Yeah, news out of the Fukushima Daiichi plant that there are indications that that three of the reactors are still undergoing nuclear fission inside. And I just want to remind people that we still don't know what the status of the fuel inside three of those reactors are. Parts of the plant are still so highly radioactive that they cannot be entered, that the company is still doing the same kind of maintenance that it did in the beginning of the crisis, the feed and bleed process, which is means pouring water into something you can't see, and then letting the hot water bleed off and pouring more cold water in. The only difference now is that they recycle as much of the water as they can, and they still don't really know where all of the water is going either. And also, this kind of puts a lie to the notion that the Japanese government said that they would have a cold shutdown by the end of the year and begin cleanup at the beginning of the new year. This really kind of puts a lie to that statement that they're far from doing a cold shutdown, and they don't even know where all of the fuel has gone that was in the reactors.
It also puts a lie to the idea that because it's no longer in the news, the crisis must be over.
Yeah, yeah. It's still very much a problem.
All right. And Gaza.
Yeah, the two more boats full of activists, 27 to be exact, one Canadian, one Irish, attempted to break the Gaza blockade this week, including a local activist from the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, Kit Kittredge of Kitsap County. They were boarded by the IDF and arrested this week, and are now being held in Israel. No, that was as of yesterday morning. No independent word yet on their condition, but at least nobody was injured or killed this time.
Yeah.
But once again, an effort to break the blockade, not successful. And once again, allegations that the IDF actually boarded the boats in international waters, which is a breach of international law and technically an act of piracy, which is an act of war against, the countries, including the United States, who had citizens on that boat. But, we probably won't be taking that quite so literally.
All right. And Libya.
Yeah, we'll probably come back to this in future weeks, but disturbing news this week that a number of the militias that were involved in the NATO-assisted effort to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi are refusing to disarm and are basically using their weapons as leverage to try and have influence in the transitional government. Now, because Libya is a tribal country with a number of different ethnicities and traditions that historically don't necessarily get along very well, very similar to Iraq, and that was papered over for many years under an authoritarian rule, we're seeing a lot of those schisms now. And the revolution and the civil war there may not be over at all. Just because Gaddafi is gone doesn't mean these folks don't still have their differences. And it's very unclear what role NATO or the U.S. Can do in that, particularly since the primary U.S. interest at this point seems to be in the oil rather than in the actual democratic aspirations of the Libyan people.
Yeah, remember Iraq in 2003, and we thought, oh, there won't be a civil war coming. Huh.
Yeah. How's that working for you?
How's that working? Yeah.
Let's just spend a minute to bounce back and talk briefly about overdose with painkillers.
Oh yeah, there was a record number of overdose deaths by painkillers in the last decade in the United States. The number has gone up from 4,000 in 1999 to 15,000 deaths in 2008. Now there are some reasons for that. One of them is our healthcare culture, where pharmaceutical companies push medicines on doctors and give them incentives to prescribe more and more and more pills. That creates a setup where people go into the doctor and they don't expect the doctor to tell them to make any lifestyle changes to deal with their back pain. No, don't change the fact that you're smoking. Don't stop drinking. Don't start exercise. Here, take a pill instead. That's a big part of the problem. Another one is the increasingly more powerful drugs that are being manufactured now, and that some of the older formulations that are less powerful are often falling off the market because they can't make as big a profit for pharmaceutical companies. companies. Those are two parts of the problem that are not being addressed. What we're seeing instead is that states and health insurance companies are trying to limit the amount of painkillers that people with legitimate pain issues can get in, with any one prescription.
And the DEA is also behind a lot
of
that.
And the DEA is pushing the insurance companies to do that in a lot of cases. So we're seeing that
we still under-medicate a lot of pain in this country.
Yeah, and we're seeing that people who are dying of cancer, people with nerve disorders, people with serious chronic pain conditions are having trouble getting enough medicine to deal with their problem. And that's a big problem.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Well, if you're going to vote, be sure to check first our Eat the State vote recommendations. That is in the free print publication that is available wherever you find free publications, hopefully. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Check it out.